My guests are political pundits Sue Maroney from the left. She's on the line. Kia ora, Sue.
Morena, Brian.
And Ben Thomas, he's with me in the studio. Kia ora, Ben.
Morena.
Great to have you both on. Ben Thomas is a former National Government Press Secretary. Sue Maroney is a former MP and Labour Party member and now Chief Executive of Community Law Centre's Aotearoa. First off, momentous week for Te Ao Māori. Now, Sue, you actually went to Tauranga Waewae, didn't you?
Yes, I was there as part of the community law delegation to the Tangihana for Ki Tuheitia. And I was there the day that the coalition government partners all turned up, which was the Wednesday last week. So it was really interesting to observe what was going on, particularly, you know, from one step removed from it all and just observing. I hadn't been there when the Labour Party had gone on in the morning, and I understand they were very warmly received. And of course, Tainui are always very gracious hosts to whoever comes to the Tauranga Waewae and their marae. And they certainly were again for the coalition partners. Shane Jones spoke first, and of course, he's very at home on the Pai Pai on a marae, and gave a very respectful address. I've seen him speak on marae a number of times. And this was probably one of the most respectful ways in which I've seen him speak on a marae. And he nearly got through it without speaking about himself. But, you know, right towards the end, as he characteristically does, he ended up speaking about himself in the third person, as Shane Jones does. And Winston was there in his role as acting PM. He didn't speak, but, you know, he was very warmly acknowledged, always feeling comfortable on a marae as well. Jerry Brownlee, as the speaker, got up again, a very respectful address, you know, apologising for not having the te reo to express himself on the marae, but spoke very respectfully on behalf of all parliamentarians. And then it was David Seymour's turn. Well, that was very interesting. Again, respectful, apologising for not having the te reo. And you could actually hear when he finished speaking, in the audience, the audible sort of gasps of respect for him having actually fronted up in the circumstances, which we all know are very tense with the agenda that he is running as the leader of the ACT Party and coalition minister. So he got served up what I would call a tainui telling off from the speaker from Tainui who spoke for Tangaro Whenua, in the most gracious of ways, just pointing out that it was that they were pleased to see David Seymour actually front up to Tauranga Waewae, that it was his first visit ever, which is really quite surprising when you think about how long he's been in Parliament, that he is about to be the Deputy Prime Minister and that he's been the leader of a party for a long time. So, yeah, lots going on politically on the marae.
Now, Ben, bringing it back to Wellington, and the death of Kingi Tuheitia and the anointment of Kuini Ngā Waihono e Te Pō as his successor, I wonder if it just changes the climate and in its own way might have an influence because on government policy in terms of the Treaty of Waitangi Principles Bill coming back before Cabinet, either is it today that's coming back to you?
Yeah, RNZ's reported that today it's going to Cabinet for consideration.
Right.
Often this particular sort of event, and by which I'm saying the death of Tuheitia's mother back in 2006, it was another one of these moments where, you know, the wider community, I think, you know, the broader New Zealand electorate really got a glimpse into sort of the kind of inner sanctum of sort of Māori tradition and ritual that a lot of times, you know, isn't obvious, you know, if you don't live in areas with a high Māori population. And I think it can have a bit of a palate cleansing effect. Mm. It can remind people that actually this is about tradition and about culture and about, you know, really unique part of being a New Zealander, whether Māori or not, which, you know, I think in 2006 Olympics. There was some amazing coverage of that tangi, just as there was of this one. And it came after the really poisonous sort of iwi kiwi election with Don Brash and Helen Clark both trying to outbid each other on how much of the foreshore they could confiscate. I think it really did help mark a break in that kind of era. Right now we're in the midst of another troublesome period as opposed to sort of at the back end. But you would hope that maybe it helps bring temperatures down. With the bill going to cabinet today, it probably won't be a very long discussion in the sense that the coalition partners have agreed in the coalition agreements that they will progress Seymour's bill to passed its first reading to the Select Committee.
Is that potentially going to cause a lot of friction? Because Select Committee events get covered, so people come along, have their say, it gets spread, those ideas are spread around through media. So the whole thing, from the point of view of National, the main coalition partner, might continue to fester.
Yeah, look, Christopher Luxon certainly didn't come into Parliament to roll back the progress of Māori rights. I think he certainly sees himself aspirationally as a kind of unifying prime minister. That's certainly, you know, where he was sort of angling himself before the complications of coalition government came to pass.
Did he misjudge the whole thing? I mean, National didn't have to say yes to what ACT wanted, did they?
I think it's fair to say, in hindsight, that the coalition partners got the better of Luxon in the negotiations. He signed up, perhaps unwittingly. You know, he's still new to politics, and he may have thought, well, look, we support this to first reading. And there's precedent for this. In 2005, the Helen Clark-led Labor government supported Winston Peters' Treaty Principles Bill to first reading that would have removed all references to the Treaty of Waitangi Principles from legislation. So there's some, and it didn't cause this much of an uproar, but I think combined with a number of other, you know, a laundry list, I guess, of other coalition policies and some more sort of inflammatory rhetoric, you know, it is difficult for National. There must be something of a temptation. I think it would be very dangerous for the coalition if they were to just sort of kill the bill at cabinet, breach the coalition agreement. But there's nothing to say that it needs to be a sort of 3 to 6 month select committee process. It could be pretty short and sharp.
Yeah, the ways of speeding that up.
I think people have
been a bit cynical here, but
People have already, you know, I think as ACT have said, people, you know, a lot of people have already made up their minds on this one. So is it something that needs to sort of take a long time? Not necessarily.
Now, Sue, coming back to you. Oh, sorry, Sue.
Yeah.
Where you go?
I was going to say there are ways of speeding up select committee processes, but on this issue, the public are going to want to have their say. They, you know, I don't think that Māoridom, for example, are going to let this bill go to select committee without making it very clear through that process what their views are. And there will be many, many Pākehā who will be joining with them as well. So it is divisive. David Seymour wants it to be divisive. And that's the problem that the coalition government has, is that here is a small party, the ACT Party, whose only real ambition is to make sure that they continue to get over the 5% threshold, to make sure that they're in parliament, and to maybe win an electorate. And all they really need to do is scratch the itch of a minority in our country who have these redneck tendencies. And they're very clear that that's their strategy, that's what they're doing, and it doesn't matter to them about the disunity that they and division that they will cause throughout the country in doing so. The major partner, the National Party, has to address that issue, and it's going to that they're being smeared with it. If they don't wish to be, then they're going to have to take some really decisive action to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Now, next year, because this year councils have been voting on whether to scrap Māori wards, and apart from two, they've chosen to keep them. But that, to some extent, just kicks the can down the road 1 year, Sue, and referendum on whether to keep Māori wards, another potentially very divisive issue in the local body elections, do you think?
Yeah, well, look, I think it's related to the issue we just talked about. It is a divisive issue. And, you know, the councils that have actually who have snubbed the government's intention on this. They're hardly hotbeds of radicalism. You know, these are councils like Rangitike, Hauraki, Tasman. You know, we've had the Waipa mayor, who is Susan O'Regan. You know, that's a National Party family coming out speaking strongly against the position that the government has put councils in, and they are rejecting it and they're actively protesting against it. So, you know, I think again that the government has misread the temperature on this issue, and they have, you know, this is, what councils are doing is a very clear sign to the government that they need to walk back very, very quickly and very swiftly all of their attacks on Māoridom, including the one that they have put now in the hands of councils.
What about you, Ben? What's your feeling on that?
Yeah, the Māori ward issue is an interesting one. I think it goes to the heart of a number of the sort of discussions that are being had around councils now. You know, do you see councils as a sort of layer of local democracy where there's some autonomy for local communities, or do you see them as essentially a quirky historical sort of artifact that basically sits in for a government department to take out the rubbish and do sewerage and that kind of, and look after libraries and parks? You know, national governments tend to see them as that. Labour governments tend to see them as the former, as this, these sort of bustling community building, whatever things. Mm. They gave them general competence, which is, you know, the sort of power to do anything they want to. That isn't sort of prohibited.
As long as they generally pay for it.
And gave them means to pay for it via rates. I mean, technically they could crank up rates as much as they liked to pay for all sorts of things. But of course, there's a natural sort of red line that they're generally older, generally
it's getting
richer,
redder too.
Generally whiter. A group of voters will sort of punish them for. And so, but it does create other incentives to, you know, spend the money on things like, you know, that you can cut a ribbon on rather than things that are under the ground that nobody notices, like water pipes. And that's led to a lot of problems. So, you know, depending on how you see councils, you sort of say, well, communities should be allowed to organise themselves however they like. And it seems fair to me that it doesn't necessarily need to be by location, you know. So what if all the farmers wanted a rep on council and there were enough to create a farming ward? Couldn't they vote in that so that they can decide who their rep on the council is? I think that's probably fair. You know, Māori wards themselves are not necessarily an expression of titidity or treaty compliance. I think that sort of thing is generally better expressed through sort of council partnerships with local iwi, which, you know, Article 2 rights, you know, really sort of more correspond to. But if you want Māori wards, or if you want any kind of wards for particular communities of interest, there seems to be no reason why, you know, council areas and communities can't set themselves up that way.
Ben, you've got your finger on the pulse of the right-wing thing as much more than I have, and I wonder if there's potential for next year when the referendum come up for the likes of the Hobson's Choice mob to say, this is your chance to take a stand, New Zealand. Do you see that as a potential happening next year?
Oh, for sure. Look, these pressure groups are always there. You know, you see the Ratepayers Union as well. They'll print off, you know, 100...
Taxpayers Federation?
Yeah.
Union, that's right, they're a union, yes.
100,000 postcards, you know, with your yes or no submission, whatever, pre-printed. You'll see that for the Treaty Principles Bill. You'll see that for the review of the treaty clauses. You know, they're like pigs in muck right now, trying to whip up their sort of base and their extensive mailing lists. So, look, and I think that is another reason why the Prime Minister, I think, misjudged things in the coalition negotiations. He probably sort of saw these things as pretty easily disposed of, discrete sort of instances. But what you actually have is a sort of continuation throughout the three-year term, which, you know, sucks a lot of oxygen away from, you know, other things you would want to concentrate on.
You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. And there's Sue Moroney coming with a comment from, is it the left, Sue?
Oh, just
at least
on
the
say,
Zoom
from,
studio.
From the ratepayers. It's from the ratepayers' perspective, actually. You know, at great cost. That's the thing that the councils are really protesting about, as well as the fundamental issue, is that they will be required to hold a poll at great cost to ratepayers because the National Party says so.
I wanted to touch base with you both about the issues of health, which don't really go away, but it was interesting. Actually, Media Watch did an interesting thing about our coverage of health, and they, and I'm sorry, I cannot tell whether, cannot remember the source of the news, but it was a really good little piece that a reporter had done. They'd gone out to a medical center in Ōtara, and they were talking to a young woman who was standing in the queue from 6 a.m. for her dad, who wasn't well enough to go to that queue, because that's what you had to do to make sure you got some attention from your local GP. But the story that really got people riled up, that the government had to do something about, to had to fix, was the toast in the maternity ward in Wellington Hospital. Nicola Willis got involved in that. I find that interesting. Sue, what did you make of that health story?
Yeah, well, look, here's a lesson for everyone, really. You can't vote for tax cuts and then not expect that these, that your health system's going to start floundering. So, you know, all of this is because the Minister of Health has directed the health system to find $1.4 billion of cuts to fund the tax cuts, to fund the $1.8 billion of subsidy going to landlords. So, you know, this is a clear lesson for people about be careful what you vote for, because now they are saying that there's going to be 200,000 hospital beds less a night per year. What that means is people getting taken out of hospital earlier than what they would normally be taken out of hospital.
Sorry, where does that figure come from, Sue?
Well, actually, the Aged Care Association released that during the week, and they said that this has been part of the consultation that's been undertaken with them, that the health system has been asked to reduce 200,000 hospital beds per night, per year. And that is going to just end up with people being chucked out of hospital early, getting sick and re-entering the system and costing the whole system more money. It's not the way to actually save money, but it is the sort of quick fix that these cuts are forcing the system to look at so that they can meet these targets of cutting $1.4 billion of funding out of our health system.
Ben, is this argument that it's just layers of management, just bureaucracy, just get rid of all that and we've got frontline? It's starting to wear a bit thin, isn't it?
Yeah, well, look, these these issues like queues out the door and, you know, 2, 3 weeks, 4 weeks to go see your GP, these aren't new. These were around prior to this government's election. You know, COVID played a part, but, you know, a large part is just the general strain on the system. It probably hasn't been helped by the Health NZ restructure or the creation of Health NZ. There's a bit of talk about, you know, the 14 layers and, you know, Shane Retty, Dr. Retty sort of...
Maybe not so many layers after all.
Well, there was no organisational chart which showed 14 layers. I mean, it was the wrong thing to focus on in the sense that, you know, you wouldn't expect that the ideal sort of organisational chart was the board of Health NZ running around attending to patients personally, you know. So then you say, well, the next person's the CE. Should they be covering all the patients? You know, there is a question about, you know, what is the ideal number? What Retty clarified he was sort of trying to get at was that when he had looked at all of these organisational charts, he saw a whole bunch of positions that he didn't really know what the meaning of them was. I think that's getting closer to the real problem, which is that actually the organisational charts of Health NZ look great. That was the basis of the reform. It was a whole bunch of consultants who drew up some wiring diagrams and you go, oh, fantastic. You know, look, it's so elegant and clean. But the reality of it is that for, what is it, 2 years old now, it's very hard for anyone to know what's actually going on in the new entity. You know, they said, well, DHBs are going, we're getting rid of those, but they still exist. You just, instead of having a chief executive, you have a sort of regional manager of something, and otherwise they sort of go on as normal. And trying to sort out this behemoth is actually what Lester Levy is sort of charged with, trying to figure out what's going on.
I did wonder, Sue, whether with the benefit of hindsight, maybe Labor could have delayed the government, Labor-led government, well, it was a Labor government, could have delayed some of its health reforms and just put a bit more money into the system because of what COVID did. But of course, another thing that Labor is now talking about is, as you mentioned before, more funding from the tax revenue side of things, a wealth tax. I mean, will Labor, do you think if they actually got back into power, they stick with that? Because they tend to have this habit of running away from tax ideas when they're in power.
Yeah, they do have that habit. And probably the worst example of it was, I think, what was the most fundamental error of the Ardern government was when they actually had the taxation working group do all the work for them, bring out the recommendations, and then they just let it lie and didn't go out and argue for it. They, in fact, seem to leave a vacuum, which is always going to be filled by the voices of extreme wealth. They're very well resourced, and if you leave a vacuum in a debate about something like taxation, of course they are going to roll in and fill in that vacuum, and that's exactly what happened. And then we had the situation where, under no discernible pressure, Jacinda Ardern announced that there would not be a capital gains tax while she was still the Prime Minister or the leader of the Labour Party. And that ruled them out for the next term of government, where they didn't have the handbrake of New Zealand First, and they could have implemented it, and they should have implemented it. So I was really pleased to hear Chris Hipkins say yesterday that they're going to make an early decision on this, that they will get their policy sorted out quite soon. And so that they have plenty of time to talk to the electorate about it and to let people know exactly what it is and what it is not. Because the other mistake I've seen Labor make over many years is make a last-minute decision to decide to back something like a capital gains tax, which, actually is not controversial at all. It's in the OECD countries, it's seen as being a normal part of a well-functioning economy and a civilized society. And last time I looked, there were only two countries in the OECD that didn't have a capital gains tax, and they were the US and Turkey, and they've probably learnt their lesson by now as well.
Ben, are they going to back off again?
If I was a
no,
better,
you don't have the finger on that pulse.
If
she
I
was
was,
closer to that one.
if I was a betting man, I would say absolutely. I'd say there'll be about three or four changes between now and two elections from now, and they will end up not doing anything. If they wanted to make a success of this, because as Sue said, there have been all these ad hoc decisions, as leadership chops and changes in opposition, which is why now might be a particularly bad time to do it. I don't know if I'd be putting money on Chris Hipkins leading the party into the next election. With controversial issues like this, I think Sue's right. It has to be fully formed when they present it. They can't just be sort of trying to come up with the answers for their FAQs on the debate stage, like David Cunliffe was in 2014. And they probably need to take a leaf out of John Key's book and say, look, here's this thing that we know is a bit controversial. We will not do it without taking it to an election. We will flesh it out in our first year, first term in government, and we'll take it to an election. And then the people can decide. Now, if they'd done that in 2017, we'd have one now. Although, depending on how quickly they got it in, it might have been repealed by January this year.
But that was exactly the strategy in 2017, and then they bottled on it. So, I think that Chris Hipkins is really clear that he will take it to this election. And I think that's absolutely the right thing to do. Make sure that it's a proper debate held with enough time for people to really understand it and understand that it's not that controversial at all. It's in fact what pretty much every other civilized society does.
Sue, Ben, thank you very much for your time.